Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
A podcast series from These Football Times. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national club or team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, and in so many places around the world though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioned devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations, or indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence and increase power by using football as a political tool. This series looks at examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces, and also questions whether, at times, football has been able to kick back or provide a means to counter such forces. This is the political football. And today we'll be talking about Spanish football in the Franco era. Following the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939, Francisco Franco's nationalist forces took control of the country and introduced a reactionary government centred on traditional values, the church and a centrally dominated unified state. His dictatorship lasted until his death in 1975. In that time, all the Spanish life came under the purview of his Movimiento Nacional, and football was no different. I'm Gary Thacker, and I'm delighted to be co-hosting this series with my good friend, Stu Horsfield. How are you doing, Stu?
Yeah, good, thank you, Gary. How are you?
I'm great, mate, thank you. Got a glass of wine, so we're ready to roll, buddy.
Excellent. Always the way. Brilliant.
Always the way, mate, yeah. Who's our guest today, Stu?
So our guest today is Mr. Paul McParlan. Paul's regular contributor to These Football Times, and hopefully people remember that he joins in Series 1 of the Political Football to talk about the game in Northern Ireland, with his particular reference to Belfast Celtic. With his wife and son, Paul's a season ticket holder at Everton and also follows his non-league side Marine. Local non-league side, that should be, sorry, yeah, Marine. As part of his Spanish degree, Paul spent a year living in Madrid during the last year of Franco's reign, where he developed an interest in the political side of football. And he's going to dip into that experience to help us discuss tonight's subject.
Hiya, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Gary. Hi to you as well, Stu. Looking forward to the conversation tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be a great one.
Yeah, I'm obviously the pressure's all on you, Paul, so you know, don't feel bad. really looking forward to this one tonight. As always, I like to broaden my knowledge passively, as all the experts just get to teach me things. But yeah, looking forward to tonight. I think it's going to be great.
Oh, I agree. So, Paul, just to kick us off then, do you want to give us an outline of the political context, the main issues around football in that time?
Yeah, I mean, so Franco's Spain really can only be understood via the Spanish Civil War, which started in July 1936 and finished in March 1939. And there are a lot of sort of misunderstandings of what the Spanish Civil War was actually about. I mean, I heard Alex Ferguson come up with a quote one time saying, you know, he made some reference to Barcelona fighting Madrid again, like he did in the Civil War. And even a renowned football authority like Simon Kuyper made some reference on the cover of a book saying that Barcelona was the last city to fall in the Spanish Civil War. Both utter nonsense. The last city to fall in the Spanish Civil War was Madrid. It wasn't Barcelona. Madrid and Barcelona were on the same side. At no stage was there ever any conflict between Madrid and Barcelona. And at no stage was Franco ever based in Madrid during the course of the Civil War. Yeah. I think most commentators, in particular, I've done a lot of reading from material from Paul Preston, who's kind of the acknowledged authority on the Spanish Civil War. And he's the brother of Peter Preston, who I think used to be the editor of The Guardian. And even better, what gives Paul such outstanding authority in these matters is that he's a massive Everton fan, so obviously anything he says has credibility straight away.
You just told me something about Paul Preston, Paul, that I never knew. I mean, I've got five or six of Paul Preston's book on the subjects, But yeah, I never knew he was an Everton fan.
He's a massive Everton fan. Obviously, he's from Merseyside, and he's of that generation on Merseyside where Liverpool was one of the few cities in the UK where the main foreign language taught was Spanish, not French. I think mainly due to the reputation Liverpool University had at that time, and certainly, you know, he was one of that generation who benefited from the links with Spain. And even at that time, in the '50s and '60s, there was a Spanish consulate in Liverpool, and there was also a Banco de España branch in Liverpool as well. So the links between Liverpool and Spain have been quite long-lasting in the past. But in terms of Paul Preston, I mean, his view would be, and I, you know, fully concur with this, was that between 1931 and 1936, the Spanish Second Republic came into being. There were three sets of elections. In 1931, the more left-wing Frente Popular won. In 1934, the more right-wing parties won. And in the final election of that republic in 1936, the Frente Popular won again. And there would be quite determined to pursue a very anti-clerical, anti-monarchist, anti-fascist, anti-military, pro-workers' rights agenda with more sort of social freedom and, you know, particularly with more freedom for the regions like Catalonia and the Basque Country. And the pace of change they were trying to force through more or less invited a response from the more traditional elements of Spanish society, the army, the church and the military and the landowners. And that was basically what brought the conflict into being. So Franco led the he didn't lead the uprising. He was one of three generals who was involved in the uprising, although he wasn't the initial leader. That was someone called General San Jorge. And he was based in Tenerife at the time because the Republican governors had taken the decision to split the Spanish generals around the Spanish sort of territories, which was quite a poor move because it meant they couldn't keep their eye on what Franco was up to in Tenerife. So Franco's forces, he was flown over to Spanish Morocco, where he had a legendary status because he'd fought with the Spanish Foreign Legion there before, and the army of Morocco was totally loyal to him. And then, supported by the German and Italian forces, I think we'll discuss this a bit more detail later, he eventually defeated the legitimately elected Democratic Republican governments by 1939. And Franco had one clear, simple aim, which was on all the Spanish coins at the time. And it's just quite simply, España, una grande y libre, Spain, one great and big.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a great summary of the time, Paul. Obviously, as well as Franco was a few years before that, was a hero of the government at the time, the right-wing government, when he suppressed the uprising in Asturias as well, using the army of Morocco, which strangely had this weird converted logic that he accused the Spanish of being the natives, the outsiders, and his army of Morocco were the actual true Spaniards, which is a little bit weird, but you know. Converted logic and Franco were easy bedfellows as time went on.
Yeah, I mean Franco, you know, he's in some ways he's easy to run to. In other ways, it's a lot more complex with him. But he certainly had a reputation amongst the army of Morocco, as you quite rightly said there, Gary. He was the youngest general in the Spanish army as well, and he developed a reputation both in the uprising in Asturias in 1934, I think it was, and with the army of Morocco in battles in Spanish possessions there, as a ruthless general who would put down opposition and would not lose any sleep over, you know, wiping out villages, wiping out towns. And he kind of gained legendary status amongst the army as well because he got married allegedly, say, on a Saturday. The following morning, he counted his honeymoon to go off and fight in a battle with the army of Morocco, and that just led to legendary status amongst the Spanish army at the time.
Yeah, as you say, you can't understand Franco, and before we sort of go into the football, understand the context of the era without understanding the Civil War. And you mentioned, sort of touched briefly there about the Italians and Germans supporting Franco, pouring in men and materiel throughout the conflict. And whereas the legitimate government, the Republican government of Spain, was abandoned by the democratic powers and primarily led by Britain, who enforced this and bullied France into not supporting. Also had a popular front government at the time, not supporting Spain by this non-intervention farce that they observed and forced the French to observe while the Germans and Italians ignored it.
Yeah, and that was a key decisive element in the Civil War itself. And also, I mean the British element of it, when you think at the time, that the key to Franco getting his troops to Spain was getting them transported from Morocco to southern Spain. And his original plan was for the Navy to transport his army across. And Franco would assume that the Navy would support the insurrection. And he was 50% right, because the Navy commanders did. However, the crews on the ships didn't. And on most of the ships of the Spanish Navy, the crews overthrew their commanders and refused to transport Franco's troops across. So secondly then, because Britain owned Gibraltar, we had the chance to intervene then, but we didn't take that chance. And then seeing the situation, Franco kind of appealed to Hitler for help. Hitler supplied his air force that enabled Franco's troops to be flown from Morocco over to southern Spain.
That's right. And, you know, actually, ahead of that, he went to Mussolini first, and Mussolini sent, I think it was 12 Saviola bombers to...
That's correct, yeah.
Half of them crashed in French Morocco.
Yeah.
And, and it was a sort of a precursor of the Italian efforts in the Spanish Civil War, where there were hardly the most effective troops that Franco had on his side.
No, they certainly were, Gary. And I think the one battle that the Republicans won in the Spanish Civil War was Guadarrama. When they came up with the Italian forces.
Yeah, Guadarrama.
Yeah.
So just moving on past the Civil War, we've sort of given a little bit of context of what what that was. So obviously afterwards, where the era we're talking about, I don't think anybody would describe Franco as a benevolent leader of a country.
No, I think that's a fair description. Although the most loyal Franco supporters would, which is the contradiction of a civil war, isn't it? But to put them in context, I mean, going a bit further back from the Spanish Civil War, if you go back to 1898, which is also a crucial year in Spanish history, because Spain lost their final two possessions, and thus Cuba and the Philippines, and that had a massive impact on the country, and on Catalonia in particular, because Catalonia's wealth was being generated by money from the Spanish colonies, and once that money disappeared, that led to sort of a resurgence again of nationalism within Catalonia. But 1898 marked the end of Spain's glorious past. Franco always regarded himself as the man who was trying to bring Spain's glorious past back to the country again, and that's kind of what he saw as his mission.
Yeah, absolutely. And they had to, obviously, before going back in that sort of period, they had this strange organisation of mock elections where they had the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party, who basically took it in turns to govern, and elections were rigged to that these would take a turn. And obviously these things cannot produce an effective government. And Alfonso XIII, who was the King of Spain at the time, come the early 1920s, things were falling apart. He invited Primo de Rivera, the general, to become a dictator of Spain. And he did that until then his plans of civil works to encourage the economy to grow eventually produced rampant inflation, and he went away to France, and Alfonso XIII abdicated to Paris as well. And that's when the First Republic came about.
Yeah, the Second Republic.
Sorry, the Second Republic, yes. Yeah. Republic came about. So let's sort of move on to the post Civil War era, and how were things looking for football from there?
Yeah, so the post Civil War era. We touched upon the fact that Franco's kind of state repression, you know, was really kind of uniquely focused on the socialist elements of the working class, and the figures vary as to how many people lost their lives in the crackdown after the end of the Civil War, but most conversation would say, at a conservative estimate, at least 300,000 people lost their lives. So Spain post Civil War was a country absolutely on its knees. And in terms of football, then, I think, I mean, there's we may touch upon this a little bit later, but there's lots of written articles claiming that Franco was a Real Madrid fan. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support that. And Real Madrid, by the end of the Civil War, they were a club in absolute tatters. I think they'd lost two-thirds of their playing staff in the Civil War on the Republican side. And they more or less had to start from scratch again. Whereas Barcelona, by contrast, because to a large extent, Barcelona hadn't been directly involved in the fighting, because although the fighting was in Catalonia, it wasn't that near Barcelona. Barcelona kept on playing, and Barcelona were involved in a Catalonian football league as well, which, strange enough, Madrid tried to participate in. And all the members of that Catalan league were quite happy for Madrid to come and play in the Catalan competition. Only one club objected, Barcelona. And Barcelona also made quite a lot of money by sending out touring teams during the Spanish Civil War as well. So Barcelona were arguably the richest club in Spain at the end of the Civil War, bizarrely enough.
Yeah, yeah. Stu?
It's like being back at school. There's so many... obviously, Gary, I'm just going to... ask you things, like I say, as always, as I hear things, I think, oh, wow, I'm interested in that. I know we've sort of covered this a lot, but can we just go back just one second with regards to the sort of impartiality of Britain and France, having sort of witnessed the rise of dictators in Mussolini and Hitler? What was the thinking there then to allow what looked like, I suppose, the potential for a third continental dictator in mainland Europe?
Do you want to go, Paul?
I'll start off. It was a very turbulent time, in the 1930s, in terms of what was going on in the world.
Yeah.
And I think as well, there was a fundamental sort of clash between different ideologies, in terms of a communist agenda coming from the USSR and a more fascist agenda coming from other elements of Western Europe. And I think the British government, from my reading, is that they were quite concerned by the what could be seen as quite an anarchist agenda that was coming from the Republican governments in Spain. And I think they were quite fearful of that spilling over into the UK in terms of the trade union movements and things like that. So I think that's part of the reason why they didn't intervene. I think secondly as well, I mean, you have to remember in the 1930s, like Oswald Mosley, potentially powerful figures in British society at the time. You know, papers like the Daily Express were running headlines, what this country needs now is another Hitler. And there's quite a bit of support for Franco's agenda in the UK as well, from certain elements of the more established elements of society. So in my view, the British government didn't want to get involved because I think there was a degree of sympathy for what Franco was doing there. I don't know if that challenged what Gary's sort of researched as well.
I think probably the main reason I would say was it's an establishment looking to not go against another force trying to re-establish an establishment. It's a very class-conscious situation. The governments of the time, even the Labour Party, didn't come out to support the duly elected democratic government in Spain, and they were all too keen, and a lot of the press as well, particularly the Daily Express and Daily Mail, were very supportive of Franco. Because they were seen to be protecting the norms of society and civilised life, rather than the works, the rights of the individual people. Spain was a very agriculturally, apart from part of the Basque Country and Catalonia, were very agricultural. And it was a throwback to the Reconquista of Spain when Isabel and Ferdinand kicked out the Moors, and they repaid the crown, repaid all the dukes and land and moneyed people of the country by giving them huge tracts of land that were often left fallow, and the workers, especially in the southern states of Andalusia, for example, they were penniless, they were day workers, they were hired and fired very quickly, and the people who owned they were called the latifunda, these large estates, and they were owned by people who lived in Madrid who hadn't really got a great deal of care about what was going on there as long as you brought them some brass in. And it's not terribly dissimilar to the upper classes in Britain at the time. And I'm just reading at the moment Homage to Caledonia, Daniel Gray's book. How the Republican government was very much by the Communist Party and the Independent Labour Party and individuals within Britain rather than the establishment, because the establishment didn't want to be seen to be supporting an anarchist revolution as they perceived it.
Yeah, and as well, I mean, going back to what you said at the start there, Stuart, I totally agree with what Gary said there. I mean, the Spanish Civil War was a cause celebre, you know, for many left-wingers in England and Scotland at that time, and, you know, many of them signed up to join the International Brigades. You may remember a trade union leader called Jack Jones, who was very influential in the 1970s, with his power over Labour governments almost. He went off to fight in the International Brigades as well, as did George Orwell, who then wrote his book Homage to Catalonia. This kind of fight against fascism inspired a whole younger generation of young British males to go out to Spain and to fight for the cause for the Republican government.
Fascinating. Sorry, I could listen. My second question was moving into the football. So, during the Civil War, then was football encouraged? You know, we've talked about it. I mean, we're on what, 8th, 9th episode now, and we look at football and, you know, its impact on society. Certainly in times of trauma and turmoil, was the football encouraged to continue during the Civil War? You know, was it a welcome distraction? Was it, you know, was it a must continue in terms of morale for the country in general, or was it seen as maybe and something that maybe wasn't a necessity at that time?
I think my understanding would be, Stu, it kind of depended on where in Spain you were at the time.
Right.
Football couldn't continue in Madrid because Madrid was more or less on the doorstep of the fighting every day, and Madrid was under constant bombardments. Similarly, the Basque Country, you know, the Basque Country was suffered greatly from the German bombers, so it was really difficult for them to continue as well. In Catalonia, as I stated before, football continues, and I think one of Franco's things he tried to ensure was, once the Civil War was over, to establish this idea of a normal society resuming. He was really keen to get the football going again, and I think he was also quite keen that there was a rivalry between Barcelona and Real Madrid.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. One of the things with particular regard to football after the war, is Franco decreed, or the government decreed, which is Franco, I guess, at the same time, that all the clubs should have Spanish names. So, like, Athletic Bilbao had to change their name to Atletico Bilbao. Barcelona had to change their name to Club Football de Barcelona rather than Barcelona Football Club. And that was just one element of the way he was sort of imposing the Castilian-Spanish hegemony over the rest of the country.
And I think as well, Franco's big thing was that the Castilian was the language of the Christians, and that was his big thing about imposing that on the football teams as well, that they all had to buy into this glorious Castilian ideology, and you couldn't do that by having foreign names.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Copa del Rey, as we understand it now, was actually called the Copa del Generalissimo not long after the Civil War, and it stayed there for quite a while as well.
Yeah, and that's a great example of the power of the Spanish language, because it wasn't just the Copa del General, it wasn't the Copa del General Franco, which could be equally acceptable names. It was the Copa del Generalissimo, and the ISIMO at the end makes it much bigger and much more important than just the noun by itself.
Yeah, there was an incident in 1943 in the Copa del Generalissimo, where Real Madrid were playing Barcelona, and it was a semi-final that played over two legs, and the first that was played in Les Corts, which was the home of Barcelona at the time, which had actually been used as a prison camp by Franco when he occupied Barcelona, and Barcelona won 3-0, and it was a big big thing for the Catalans to be seen to triumph over Castilians, because they had made that link that Madrid in the government, Castile. And the return, which was played at Jean Martin, which was the home of Real Madrid before the Bernabeu, there was a big thing in the paper that all Spanish people should get out and support Real Madrid. It's very much government-backed. And there's, I've read several accounts that before the game, a person of high rank, military rank, went into the Barcelona dressing room with a gun, explained that there was only one team going to win that game, and Real Madrid won 11-1. And you make of that what you will, and perhaps these stories become apocryphal, but there's so many accounts of it that it's almost, there's too many accounts of it not to have some bearing in reality. And I guess this is just a case of, there again, as Paul said, that Franco was using football to increase the power of Castilian Spain.
I think what's quite interesting about that, though, Gary, is I've read that story as well, but what most researchers don't also point out was that the year before, Barcelona actually won the Copa del Generalissimo, and a lot of the thinking was that Franco was quite happy to have two strong teams, but he didn't want Barcelona to be the strongest team two seasons on the run. He wanted Real to win at least one of those cups.
Yeah, I guess there's two ways of looking at that. You know, there's that sort of interpretation, and there's also the interpretation that Franco was determined not to let it happen again. Now, I mean, you know, it's tomato or tomato, isn't it, really? I mean,
it is, yeah. Yeah,
of these
yeah,
things. But yeah. I guess in either instance, there's certainly some element of political involvement in the game there.
Oh, certainly. And given how Spain was as a society in the 1940s, you would give total credence to the Barcelona Council what happened in that dressing room before the game.
Indeed, Stu. I'm just conscious. I'm monopolising this, mate.
Honestly, like I say, I'm in such a privileged position in these podcasts. It is, you know, it's just at the steepest learning curve that I'm ever on, and I don't want to break up your discussions, but it's funny, isn't it? I mean, we talk about this all the time, Gary. I can remember when we talked about the Turkish one, you know, in Series One, and it's fascinating how football always seems to become like not a pinch point, but a focal point for the leaders of nations as a way of identifying or a certain control or a certain dominance or a certain ideology or a certain manifesto. And it doesn't seem to matter which country we've looked at so far in our sort of eight episodes. It's always there. Football seems to be, granted we're a football podcast and a football site, but football seems to always be there and thereabouts in terms of political figures using it, yeah, you know, as a way of instilling, like we said, even just with the names of teams, you know, it's a way of instilling control, yeah, it's a way of instilling an ideology, it's a way of, you know, almost communicating, I suppose, with the masses, isn't it? I suppose that's, now I think about it, that's probably what it is. If you communicate through football, you're going to reach such a wide audience than, you know, probably most other mediums, I would assume.
Yeah, and also, Christian, and also, if you're then seen to be bringing your side success, then you therefore buy into the loyalty of those people as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, even before Franco, there was an occasion where, this is when Primo de Rivera was the dictator, Barcelona playing a home game. I can't remember who they were playing against, but they had a band, the Royal Marines, doing a half-time music, and they played the Spanish national anthem and everybody booed. The Royal March, and then they played God Save the Queen, and everybody cheered. And perhaps if they'd have known how Britain was going to desert them, and the news later, they perhaps would have booed that one as well. But you know, you're right, and I think it's I'm just seeing Paul's take on this, but so many people would it's the easy myth to take on board that Real Madrid were Franco's team. Well, that's probably not true. But what Franco did was he was very happy to wrap himself around the glory of Real Madrid when they were the dominant power in European football because they were Spanish, and that suited his purposes magnificently.
Yeah, I think you called it 100% correct there, Gary. I think, well, I mean, from the stuff I've kind of researched, I mean, Franco wasn't from Madrid. You know, he was from a small village in Galicia. So he had no obvious connections with Real Madrid as a football team. Real Madrid as a football team weren't that good before the Spanish Civil War. They didn't have, you know, the global reputation that they have now. They didn't even have a reputation within Spain that they have now. Most commentators take the view that Franco actually supported Athletic Bilbao because they were the team of the time. Franco loved the Basque Country. It was the land of the conquistadores. He was enthralled by their culture. He had a real sort of passion for all things Basque. And the Real Madrid thing, Franco would have been daft not to have aligned himself with Real Madrid. Because when you think most people, where Spain was at the end of the Civil War, where Spain was as you got into the 1950s, suddenly this prestigious competition where the cross-continental appeal was created and the top team playing in that competition was from Madrid. And so obviously Franco was going to associate himself with that. I mean, it's also fair to say that Franco was allowed Atletico Madrid to restart again at the end of the Civil War as well. And Jesus Gil, who was sort of the controversial leader of Atletico Madrid, had a framed photograph of Franco in his office. So, you know, it was more than just about Real Madrid with Franco. And I think one of the... I think Franco just loved being associated with the success of Real Madrid. It changed perceptions of Spain as a society across the continent, as I mentioned before. And I think when Ferenc Puskas defected from Hungary, and then he eventually, after about 18 months, was coaxed to join Real Madrid, that was such a propaganda coup for Franco because he'd attracted a star communist player from a star communist state to come and play and earn his living in Spain.
Yeah, and not only a star communist player from a star communist state, but one that's been ousted by another communist state, invading that first communist state. Yeah,
exactly.
It's also a nice little contrast that a lot of people may not realise, but Real Madrid as a club was actually founded by a Catalan.
It was indeed.
Carlos Padrós Rubio founded Real Madrid, and rather than a Castilian Spaniard. But just leaving Real Madrid and Barcelona and Catalan conflicts. I want to come to the Basque Country in a bit, but I just want to ask you about socially within cities. So a lot of people perceive that Real Madrid are the aristocratic team of Madrid, and Atletico are the working class, much like Sevilla and Betis might be in Seville. But that's not necessarily true, is it, Paul?
That's not my understanding, really, Gary. I mean, I think a lot of that was initially based around the locations of the two stadiums, because you know, the new Bernabéu stadium was always in quite an affluent part of Madrid, whereas the old Atletico stadium was in quite a working class area of Madrid. But I think but when I was there in the 70s, I went to both grounds, and I was only a naive 19-year-old at the time, so I wasn't that perceptive, but I didn't notice any great difference in class between the two sets of supporters at all. And I think as well, the supporters actually have got a lot more in common in terms of their sort of pro-fascist views than their class differences.
Yeah, I think, as I say, I just think it's probably an easy sort of trap to fall into.
I think most people would accept the working class team from Madrid is Rayo Vallecano.
And I guess if there was that, you know, if there was that dichotomy between those two sides and between two clubs in other cities as well across Spain, that, you know, a Franco government would be supporting those aristocratic clubs, and that didn't really happen. And I guess Franco really wasn't overly interested in football at all, other than it being a vehicle for the glorification of Spain.
I totally agree there, Gary. I mean, there's no evidence to support the fact that Franco had any interest in football or anything. His biggest interest was bullfighting, because that was the more traditional Spanish sports.
Indeed. Stu?
Yeah, it's funny, you took the question right out of my mouth there, Gary. I was about to say, you know, again, going back, you know, the whole propaganda element, and you're right, you know, the 1950s, you know, the European Cup, the timing and everything was perfect, the team was perfect, the competition was perfect for a political leader, you know, propaganda, but, you know, I suppose, like I say, it was... you know, was there a genuine interest in the game of football, or was it more political shrewdness where you seize upon the opportunity, which I suppose all great political leaders do, don't they? You know, they see the smallest opportunity to self-promote or promote their values and their ideals and promote it to as wider audience as possible. So, I guess you've kind of answered my question there. But I was going to ask as well, Paul.
But Stu, can you just come back to that?
There's
There's a word that's often used to describe Franco, and it's called in Spanish Rey Tranca, and it's a characteristic for people from Galicia. And what it means is you never know what they're thinking. And there's a saying in Spain that if you meet a Galician on a staircase, it's impossible to tell if you're going upstairs or downstairs because you don't give anything away. In terms of Franco, he didn't give anything away football wise. And you look at his career, you know, this man played Hitler. He played Mussolini, he played the British government, he played the United Nations, he played the Pope. This guy made a career out of not letting anybody know what he was really thinking.
That's very true, actually. I like your quote as well, Paul. I've heard the thing about Gallegos and their inscrutability.
Can I just ask? So, what was the perception of the national team at this time then, with regards to obviously the end of the Civil War, the conflict? You know, how did that manifest itself, I suppose, in the Spanish national team, which is, to be fair, we were chatting about this in the last edition, in the Brazil edition, and how, you know, how when a national team meets up, you can end up with players supporting different sides, different beliefs, different values, and the turmoil that could potentially create. I just wondered how that manifested itself at that time with regards to the Spanish national team.
Paul?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a difficult one to answer that, Stu.
Sorry.
that's your job. I think it took Spanish football a long while to recover from the Civil War, and particularly it took the national team a long time to recover from the Civil War as well. Spain had a good opportunity in 1960 to win the European Nations Cup that was being held in Russia. And Spain were drawn against the USSR, and Franco refused to allow the Spanish team to travel to the USSR to complete the fixture. And that was quite a rare sort of propaganda mistake by Franco, because that would have helped to establish Spain as not only a club power via Real Madrid, but also an international power via the international team as well. And I think also, at that time in the 1950s, Spain was having to attract foreign footballers to improve the quality of the league. So that's why Alexis Di Stefano was bought. That's why Alexis Puskas was brought over. That's why Kubala from Hungary went over to Barcelona. And so, similar maybe to the Premier League these days, maybe there weren't that many opportunities for young aspiring Spanish footballers to establish themselves in the team, and then also to move on to the next level with the international side.
I have another question, but it can come later on, further down the discussion. I have another question now. That's fine.
That's exactly the answer I would have given, Paul. And I think it's dead right that the Spanish clubs were successful, but they were dominated by a lot of foreign players. And not only that, but this guy called Luis Suarez, not the guy who plays for Barcelona now, but who actually played for Barcelona years ago, and when Helenio Herrera was the manager. When went to Inter, he took Suarez with him, and he built his grand Inter team around Luis Suarez. But he was one of the rare exceptions, and just picking up when you said about the 1960 Nations Cup, 64, the tournament was played in Spain. Luis Suarez captained Spain, and they won it in front of Franco in Madrid, which would have pleased him no end.
And even better, Gary, they beat the USSR in the final.
They beat the USSR, and the USSR turned up and to play. And yes, you're right, they beat the USSR, which was obviously there was this antipathy, because in going back to the Spanish Civil War, the only friend, well, not the only friend, that's not true, because Mexico was also supportive, but the main supplier of arms to the Republican government was the USSR, and therefore there was always this antipathy that Franco had, not only because they were communist, but because they supported his enemies in the Spanish Civil War as well, so that the victory would have been all so sweet.
Yeah, indeed, Gary. And also, I mean, although Stalin did support the Republican efforts in the Spanish Civil War, it's also fair to say he supported the communist elements of the Republican defence rather than the general elements of the Republican defence. And that led to most of the discord in Barcelona, which ended up with the anarchists and the communists fighting each other on the streets of Barcelona instead of fighting against the common enemy of Franco's government.
That's right. We mentioned about George Orwell earlier. George Orwell actually wasn't in the Republican Army. He fought with a POOM. The anarchist led by Andrés Nin in Barcelona. And when the communists were supplying, the Russians were supplying arms, one of the diktats they had was they'd go to the Republican battalions that were controlled by the communists, and hence, as you said, the battles with the anarchists. And the other thing is that Stalin was playing a real tightrope walking game there, because he didn't really want the Republicans to win, because he was concerned that it would be seen as a communist infiltration into Western Europe and all the trouble that could cause him when he was trying to rebuild the Russian army anyway, without upsetting the Western democratic power. So he wanted the war to go on a little bit longer, but just keep everybody still fighting, but not necessarily winning or losing.
That's right, Gary.
And not a similar thing, because he wanted to use the Spanish Civil War to practice his tactics for the Second World War.
He did, and Pablo Picasso's famous painting of Guernica demonstrates, the destruction of the German Blitzkrieg foisted upon Spain. Hitler learns a lot from that. I think Hitler learned two things: that one, the effectiveness of bombing campaigns, and two, never trust the Italians to fight on your side.
I've got a book here about posters from the Spanish Civil War. And there's the famous one, which the Manic Street Preachers did a song about, and it's to do with the aerial bombardment of Madrid. And there's a picture of this woman carrying under with her children. And if you tolerate this, then your children will be next.
And we did
tolerate it, and our children were next.
And bizarrely enough, as well, I mean, it's one of the things there's not much research on is that during the Second World War, when Franco was under a lot of pressure from Hitler to come in on the side of the Axis powers, Franco organised a recruiting campaign in Spain for people to go and fight for Germany on the Russian front.
He did.
And over 10,000 people volunteered to go and fight for Spain, to go and fight as a Spanish Legion army on the German side on the Russian front in the early 1940s, which, when you look back now, is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it was the battalion Azov, the Blue Battalion.
It was.
They were disastrous, and they got sent back. It's a bit like there was an Irish contingent in the Spanish Civil War under the General Eamon O'Duffy. They were called the Blue Brigade as well, and they went to fight for Franco in Spain. And O'Duffy had this idea that he was going to be triumphant in there, because it's a Catholic country in Ireland, they were supporting Franco, that he could have a successful campaign in there, come back and then make a run for to control the country of Ireland. But obviously they went out there and they were disastrous battalions. Well, they ended up firing on each other in the one battle they were involved with, and before they were sent back and deemed, well, okay, guys, we'll do without you. But we'll drift off football a bit, and I want to sort of get back to the Basque country. And there's a big thing, and a lot of people understand that or perceive that the big thing, and you mentioned about Ferguson saying about Catalonia and Barcelona and Real Madrid, and Terry Venables wrote a piece of Terry Venables wrote that if ever they win away in Real Madrid, when they return to Barcelona, they're treated as the Republican army coming back from a victory. And a little bit strange there, but obviously the Basque country was a big element in the war, and in obviously being taking the impact of Franco's repression afterwards.
When I was in 75, what most of the local people in Madrid and the media were concerned about was the Basque country. Catalonia didn't really figure in terms of an impact, apart from the football of Barcelona. The Basque country was something else. I mean, certainly, lots of the people I spoke to in Madrid at the time, and for some reason there were lots of Basques in Madrid when I was there, and they were just getting arrested all the time, being picked off the streets, locked up overnight, beaten up, thrown out again the next day. And they just kind of calmly accepted this as kind of a price to pay for being Basque in Madrid. And that attitude's kind of still lingered a little bit today with the Ultra Brigades, both Real and Atletico. Yeah. Now, I think that, I mean, the two Basque sides, obviously, Atletico Bilbao's policy of only playing Basque players, which Sociedad had to about 1989, I believe, was quite a binding thing for much more so than Barcelona, because Barcelona never had a policy of just playing only Catalan players, whereas the national identity strength was much stronger in the Basque country. Franco, because he loved the Basque country so much, hated them after the Civil War because he felt they'd been traitors, they'd let down the Spanish tradition, the Spanish culture, and he had a real sort of downer on their football clubs as well. And I think trying to make life quite difficult for them at times. But yeah, if one section of Spain caused Franco's government consistent problems, it was the Basque country, it wasn't Catalonia.
Yeah. Obviously, there was the ETA with a violent separatist movement, which didn't really exist, had a counterpart in Catalonia.
No,
he's probably a factor there.
Yeah, but I mentioned before that there's a quote, another Spanish quote here, sorry, there's a quote about Catalan, and it's, "Los catalanes miran con la peseta," which means Catalans are very money conscious, they like to gather money. And because Catalan society actually did really well under the Franco government in the 1950s and 60s, there was no great campaigns, you know, for independence, because a lot of people were becoming very wealthy. And at the time, when USA poured into Spain in the 1950s, when Spain got funding via the Marshall Plan, then that meant that suddenly all this wealth is being generated in Catalonia, and people did not want to lose access to those funds, and they wanted to keep on side with the government, because to fall out of favour with Franco might mean losing valuable contracts and things like that. The Basque country never quite had the same attitude, and Ace starts off by blowing up railway lines and kind of robberies and things like that, but in 1973, they struck the most decisive blow against Franco's government during his whole time in power, when they blew up the Prime Minister of the time, Luis Carrero Blanco, live on national Spanish TV. And the man who was due to continue Francoism after Franco was gone. And that was such a massive blow to the Franco government.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess gives it a context that the Basque country was part of the Republican resistance to Franco in the Spanish Civil War, and they had this this defensive armament called the Ring of Iron around Bilbao, and they thought that they could defend the Basque country because of that, but they were betrayed by a Basque who went across to the Nationalists and gave away the secret of where to get around, and of course the bombing of Guernica. And the Basques, I think it was Molder, the General Molder, was it in the north, who said he was going to destroy San Sebastian unless the Basques surrendered. And they hadn't got a great deal of hope of holding out, and that's what happened. And obviously then he got all the armaments factories and steel production that were the Basque country, one of the industrial powerhouses of Spain.
Yeah,
there was that sort of resentment, wasn't there?
And also, I mean the Basque country, lots of Basque children were evacuated from Bilbao, weren't they? They sailed to Southampton on the the Havana ship.
That's right.
It came up in 37 or 38. And then there's so many interesting accounts of what it was like for the Basque kids going over to Southampton, adjusting to life in the UK compared to what they'd experienced in the Basque country in Spain in the Civil War. I think some of them settled here. I think quite a few of them went back at some stage. But The Basque country is quite interesting because the Spanish side of the Basque country has four provinces. Two of the provinces were loyal to the Republic. Two of the provinces were loyal to Franco. So it wasn't a united Basque country defence against Franco. 50% of the Basque country state laws, the Republican government. The other 50% didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, you're absolutely right, but I think most people would consider the Gaspurkaya and Vizcaya as the because obviously the other two areas you're talking about are Alava and Navarre. Navarre don't even consider themselves as being Basque themselves. And
no.
There's a massive Carlist powerhouse in Pamplona, the home of Osasuna Football Club. And the Roquettes, who were one of the prime forces of Franco's Spanish army, who were very, they were almost very arch religion, almost like a reincarnation of the Spanish Inquisition. And they were, you know, couldn't be more anti-republican if they tried. But Navarre's a funny area because there's not enough percentage of Basques living in Navarre to make it predominantly Basque, although geographically it sits between two Basque areas.
It's a strange mixture of views on Navarre, because there's quite a strong traditionalist sort of pro-church, pro-Catholic view there, and I think it's more the northern half of Navarre sees themselves more as being Basque, don't they?
Yeah, but I say there's not the percentage of people who consider themselves Basque as there is in the two northern states, the two states that border the Bay of Biscay. But you know, it's interesting. One, and I guess there again, that's one of the reasons why the certainly Osasuna don't have any issues with Basque identity, as opposed to, as you mentioned, Real Sociedad and Athletic Bilbao, obviously massively do. So it was an interesting game a few years back. I was actually in. One of the Spanish islands at the time, and there was, it was called the Flag Derby, and Barcelona played Bilbao, and there was no reason for either of them to change kits, but they both did, and Barcelona played in red and yellow stripes, or they were contended to be gold and blood stripes, and to represent the senyor of their flag of Catalonia, and Athletic Bilbao played in green, white and red. The Basque colours represent the Basque flag, the Coruña, which represents the green fields, the white houses, and the Basque blood. And it was one of those sort of nationalist statements that clubs do almost because it's a nod to their fans that they feel they have to do these things at times, because at that time the Catalan independence movement was quite restrained, as was the Basques at the time.
Yeah, but I think that was also another example, in my view, of Catalonia following the Basque country's example, because in 1976, the year after Franco died, there was a game when Sociedad played Bilbao, and the two teams came out with the Basque national flag, the Ucariña. And watching that game was Colonel Tejero,
who
sat around watching with his friends and said, "This has gone too far. We can't have these people parading their national flag. We've got to do something to save Spain." And then that started his sort of planning. And 4 years later, he's the one who marched into Spanish Cortes, firing his shotguns, demanding that everyone gets their head down and trying to restore a military dictatorship in Spain. And what inspired him to do that, apparently, was seeing the Basque flag being displayed so blatantly at a football game.
Yeah, it's interesting that the captain's armband of the two Basque clubs, the Sociedad and Bilbao, are representations of the flag of the Coruña, and as is the ones that Barcelona captains wear, which is the Senyora representation of their flag.
Yeah. Can I just ask? In terms of, you know, what you said about there and the clubs, and, you know, I suppose clubs demonstrating loyalty to fans and almost not tribalism, but certainly geographical location where they are and what that stands for. Can I ask, Paul, who, in terms of players, you know, over this prolonged period, I suppose, from end of the Second World War to the 70s, were there any politically astute players who were very visible, vocal at that time, either obviously pro, you know, or against the Franco regime? I mean, we talked about, and I keep going about Brazil, but we talked about Brazil last time, you know, obviously Socrates comes up. But in terms of sort of political astuteness from players, was there any evidence over this period of politically astute players?
I think my answer to that, Stu, would be quite simple. I don't think there were. I think for any Spanish-born player, to be coming out and making a statement about independence of the regions, or to be broadcasting an anti-Franco agenda, I think would be simply signifying the end of their career.
Really?
That's my view.
I think that's true.
Certainly from my time there in 75, I have no recollection whatsoever of anyone standing up and saying anything against Franco's government. Certainly on the street, you didn't say anything about it, it wouldn't have really suited any footballer who wants to make a career in Spain to say anything publicly. Obviously, behind the scenes, in the dressing rooms, things might not have been said, but in terms of a public statement, given the way Franco was so totally dominant in terms of control of the country, that would have been a very, very brave footballer who made a statement and, was prepared, because they couldn't guarantee that he would have any followers. I mean, I guess there might well be some examples of Basque footballers who did that, but because when I was there, the press was censored, so you'd never find out about it anyway.
I think like most footballers, and we as Stuart mentioned, we talked about this with the Brazil thing, and we were saying why no British players sort of speak out in political things. And I think the reason might be very similar to what we're discussing now. There might be just a quiet acquiescence of it's easier to keep your head down and keep your gob shut and not get into any trouble that way.
Yeah, and you kind of forget, it's nearly sort of 44 years since Franco died. And people forget now what it was like to live under a dictatorship. No one under the age of 45 knows in Western Europe what it was like to live under a dictatorship. And so that collective memory of what it's like to live under a dictatorship with a censored press and censored TV and censored media outlets, with police listening to your every word, with people listening to your conversations, with people stopping on the streets because you've voiced an anti-government view, no one growing up now has any concept of what that society is like.
When you did you say you were you 19 when you were there, Paul?
Yeah, I was 19 when I was there, Stu. Incredibly young, naive 19.
I was just about to ask that. Could you pick up on that almost subversive, way of living or way of controlling the populace? Could you feel it? Could you sense it? Could you pick up on it? Was it very evident to you?
Oh yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, before we went out there, we were given just quite an induction as to how to conduct ourselves, what to say, what not to say, that type of thing. One of the first things I did before I went out there was I had quite long hair at the time. If you see my Slack photograph, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I got it all cut dead short because I didn't want to be drawn to myself as a long-haired lefty. And so that was one of the first things I did before I went out there. And in Madrid at that time, there was sort of a pro-government, pro-Franco graffiti was everywhere, but any anti-Franco graffiti was swiftly removed in about 24 hours. All we saw on the streets was pro-Franco graffiti. You've read the press, and you're trying to get to the real story here. What's actually going on? Because we were young and British, we attracted a certain amount of attention, and certainly there were a time, as in, we socialised with quite a few of the Basque students, which, looking back, probably wasn't the wisest thing to have done. And remember one time where we stayed near the Puerta del Sol, and there was a massive government building, which was kind of unofficially a detention centre. And the Spanish police in the cities at that time, and there was Los Grises, the Policía Armada, and they were absolutely ruthless. And one time, one of our Basque friends had been arrested, basically just for being Basque, and was getting marched off. And we kind of said quietly, "Excuse me, you can't do that. What have you done wrong?" And the guy just policeman turned around to my friends, pointed the gun at his temple, said, "I've got a license to kill. If you don't move, I'm going to use it." We moved very quickly.
Oh, my word. That answers that.
And then the other thing was as well, we soon learned not to talk, to say that we were British, because the whole Gibraltar agenda was such a big thing in Spanish society at the time. And as soon as you spoke to anyone over 30 and you mentioned you were British, all they wanted to talk about, why have you not given Gibraltar back to Spain? Gibraltar's ours, you should give it back. And so in the end, I just pretend to be Irish because it was easier to pretend to be Irish because straight away they'd engage in an anti-British conversation because they assumed you were Irish, which worked out really well. But I mean, Franco's treatment of Gibraltar was absolutely appalling. One of the guys on my course, Francisco Montegrifo, was from Gibraltar. And me and Gary know from touring around Spain, I think the distance from the Spanish border to Gibraltar is about, 800 yards, a kilometre at the most. At that time, Franco closed down the border between Spain and Gibraltar. He then extended Spanish airspace over Gibraltar airspace, which meant the planes flying into Gibraltar had the most hazardous manoeuvres to get onto the airport successfully. Because he closed the border down, when my friend went home, he had to get a ferry from Algeciras to Tangier in Morocco, then a ferry back from Tangier in Morocco to Gibraltar that took him about 5 hours for a journey that's about 800 yards at the most. And he and the other Gibraltarians I met detested Franco with an absolute vengeance. And one thing that always stuck in my mind was there was one time, I think Gerald Ford came over to visit Franco about, I think it was about May 1975, and we were in a bar. And we were all just laughing at the state of Franco because he looked like death warmed up. He just looked so ill, and we were making jokes about him. And after about 5 minutes, we realised that everyone on the bar was silent and everyone on the bar was looking at us. And then we kind of looked around, and the owner just came up and says, "If I were you, I would leave now." And we left straight away. So it was a very, very scary place, Spain, at that time. And we drew attention because we were British and because we were young. But, I mean, some of the younger Spanish students who we met, quite often they'd invite us around to their houses and then they'd give us anti-Franco leaflets, they'd talk about their issues with the government, but never outside the house. You didn't really want to get into public conversation because you never knew at any stage who's going to listen to you, and you never knew what the repercussions were of people listening to you.
Yeah, it's interesting. We mentioned about Gibraltar, and there's an interesting contrast in saying about the logic being turned on its head. Spain has two enclaves in Morocco, Ceuta and Melilla, which they don't have the same issue about in British Britain and Gibraltar. And those two things never get mentioned in the same breath, but they should because they're identical. I just want to ask about clubs in Barcelona. Barcelona themselves and Espanyol, and obviously Barcelona perceived widely to be the club of Catalan independence, the Catalan club that represents, they wear the colours, they fly the flag, and when you go to watch Barcelona at the Nou Camp, they have their Senyora flag, they have their Estelada as well, this flag of Spanish Catalan independence. But then again, that's the sort of perception and reality things aren't necessarily the same thing, are they?
No, I'd agree, Gary. Yeah, I mean, I think there's most Espanyol fans, you know, have a different view of Barcelona than the one Barcelona like to portray across Europe themselves. Barcelona were founded by foreigners. I think was a Hans Gamper, a Swiss guy.
Yeah, Gamper,
yeah.
He's Swiss.
Yeah, and Espanyol were founded the year afterwards, and when they were founded, the quote their founder was, you know, "We have created this side to compete with the foreigners of Barcelona," and that's why they chose the name Espanyol, because they were the Spanish team, they were the national, they were the nationalists within Barcelona. Certainly, most Espanyol fans feel as though, as a club, they have been totally marginalised by the media operation that is Barcelona. They feel that even Catalan State TV or the Catalan media outlets don't give them anything like the coverage that they give to Barcelona. I mean, if you buy El Mundo Deportivo in Barcelona, you have to plow through about 22 pages about Barcelona before you get anything in Espanyol.
It's true. The sport's the same. There's one called Sport, and that's exactly the same sport.
Yeah. And so you can see where the Espanyol fans are coming from there, you know. And Espanyol fans would claim that the people who watch their team are from Barcelona. They'd also say the people who watch Barcelona are tourists. And if you follow any of the Twitter accounts of other clubs in Spain, they all refer to Barcelona as El Club de los Turistas. They're just a tourist club. They're not a football club. And Espanyol kind of distanced themselves from the Catalonian nationalist movements, you know, that they are quite pro keeping Spain as it is. And Gerard Piqué is a particular hate figure with Espanyol fans. And they have a series of quite abusive chants about Shakira, his wife.
That's right.
Which I'm not going to repeat here.
No.
But also, when they last met in the Spanish Cup this season, at the end of the game, a few years ago, Espanyol added De Barcelona onto their club name so people would understand they're from Barcelona. They then moved their ground to outside of Barcelona, and then Gerard Piqué made some reference to them not being from Barcelona, being from outside of the city, and that really did not go down well with Espanyol fans, because they are saying, actually, we are the team of Barcelona. No, we are the team people in Barcelona support. You are not.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been to see Barcelona. I've never been to watch Espanyol play, to be honest, but I've been to see Barcelona play many times, and the ground is always stalled out because it's a club owned by its members and members of the season tickets and such like. But the ground's never full, because owning a Barcelona season ticket is a status symbol. You don't have to be a football fan, but you have to be. It's a symbol of a hierarchy within the society of the city. It's a strange thing that a lot of season ticket holders don't go to watch Barcelona play. It's a different thing entirely.
Still, it's a bit like Arsenal. Yeah, so it sounds a bit like Arsenal, that. No, but I think that's true. I think Barcelona fans refer to Espanyol's ground as the mini Bernabeu. Right. And I think that Barcelona fans see Espanyol and Real as an unholy alliance. And certainly, if you read some comments from Madrid fans on social media, if they go to Barcelona, they would often go to watch Espanyol rather than Barcelona, and made to feel a lot more welcome there as well. So no, there is quite an Espanyol. They're a relatively successful team. You know, they've won a few cups in their time. They've competed in Europe. They're not sort of like a lower league team. No, they're a team with tradition, a team with a decent level of support, nothing like Barcelona's. And I think that they've just felt totally marginalised, and to an extent you could take the view that they represent the elements of Catalan society that aren't pro-independence.
Yeah, true. Steve?
I suppose a final question for me, Paul. I mean, I like to sum up with big general questions that are usually quite difficult. If you were to look at, I mean, hindsight's a great thing, isn't it? But if you look at Spanish football and where it is now and where it sits, and, you know, the players it produces, the managers it produces, the clubs, the national side it produces, do you think that the Franco regime held Spanish football back? Do you think it stifled Spanish football, or was it just of its time and, you know, that was the state of Spanish football regardless of whose regime had been in power at that time?
Well, I think on the international stage, you only have to look at Spain's achievements since Franco died to answer that question. When Franco was in power, Spain as an international footballing power didn't really have any great status. Whereas since, you know, in recent times, with the success of the Spanish national team, they've certainly been much more successful post Franco. In terms of the club sides, I think, you know, the legacy of Real Madrid is all embracing. And they certainly benefited from the backing or an association with General Franco during the 1950s and onwards. So I think Spanish football today is unrecognisable from the Spanish football that was played during the times of Franco. The stage is unrecognisable. The society is unrecognisable. The type of players they have playing in the leagues are unrecognisable. And certainly, I think there would have been cases in the 50s and 60s where maybe some star players from other countries might not have been attracted to go to Madrid because of the political regime there. And obviously, that's certainly not the case today for Real Madrid. Conversely, it might be the case for Barcelona at the moment, you don't know.
No, it's funny. I mean, you know, like you said, we start off talking about how, you know, football is almost the conduit to you know, to communicate with people, and it's just like you say. You look at the glory of Real Madrid, but you know, one could almost argue that maybe stifled Spanish football, having that one team dominance. And you know, we've had it in the Premier League, you know, with Manchester United to begin with, and now we're starting to see a slightly fairer. You see it in Scotland, and you know, you just. I just find it interesting as to how much influence political regimes have. Aligning yourself to the game for propaganda is one thing, but actually becoming a detrimental force to the game and its development is something completely different, and you know, and something that you know only history will be able to look back on and answer those questions, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's right, Stu. I mean, certainly there's no getting away from the fact that Real Madrid's success in the 1950s kind of helped to legitimise Franco's regime in the eyes of most of Western Europe. And I think that was kind of a very mutual beneficial relationship.
Yeah. There's a famous quote, famous or infamous quote by Florentino Perez, the Real Madrid president, who said that if Barcelona didn't exist, Real Madrid would have to invent them. That's how they sort of define themselves in sort of contrast to each other.
I think it'd be really interesting to see if the Catalan independence movement does actually succeed, how that's going to pan out for Barcelona in terms of where they're going to play. Are their players going to be able to play for Spain? It's just a fascinating situation. It's going to be really interesting to see how that develops, because it's going to have a massive impact on European football if that were to be the case.
You're right. It's almost like Turkey's right for Christmas, and that runs a little bit prosaic to put it that way. But you know, they would be taking themselves out of a league that's at some levels very competitive, into a situation where there would be almost no competition for them other than Espanyol and some junior clubs. And
I'm not even sure Espanyol would agree to play for that.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of living over here. It's the Catalan independence thing seems to have sort of gone down, quite down a bit since the uproar of a few months ago. But who knows what's happening in the future?
I think as well, Gary. I mean, I was in Madrid in September, and what I've noticed for the first time that I've been during the time I visited Madrid is there's been a real resurgence of Spanish nationalism in Madrid. For the first time I was walking along the streets since 1975, obviously 1975, everyone's displaying pro-Franco stuff, you had to. Being back since then, and you know, there's no massive displays of Spanish flags and things like that. But this September, I was astounded by the number of Spanish flags that were flying everywhere on the streets, in the cafes. And I think the Catalan movement has kind of generated a real resurgence of nationalism.
Yeah.
In Madrid and in other parts of Spain as well. And I think, you know, you look at the Basque country, they're very concerned by this resurgence in nationalism, because they appear to be quite happy with the arrangement they have in Madrid at the moment. But they're just keeping a watchful eye on what's going on in Catalonia and what's going on in Madrid, because, you know, an upsurge in nationalist feelings is also going to impact upon the regions. And if Catalonia attains independence, then the other regions of Spain are going to be in quite a difficult situation.
Yeah, you're right. So, I mean, where we are in Spain, there is a fair amount of Spanish flags. Now, I'm not sure if that's normal, because we've only been out here since August. But certainly, you know, if you go to the bars to watch La Liga, there's far more people there vociferously and passionately following Real Madrid than if Barcelona are on there. Not many people necessarily go there anyway. So Real Madrid are still seen to be Spanish people's team, if that's not too simplistic. But Barcelona is looked down, well, not held in high regard anyway. Just want to sort of, we always try to finish with the same question, but I want to tweak it a little bit, because obviously we're talking about an historical period. So, you know, I always say, we normally start with, can football exist? But, you know, was it possible for football to have existed in that political vacuum with post-Franco era? Or does the passion that the game engendered too easily lend itself to being a political tool? So was the political football inevitable in the Franco era?
I think, given how the Franco estate was created, then inevitably politics was going to have a massive influence on football in Spanish society at that time. it would have been quite interesting to see how Spanish football may have developed if the Second Republic had actually won the Civil War and the direction Spanish society may have taken as a consequence of that. So undoubtedly, you cannot speak about Franco's Spain without discussing the influence of politics within his governments at that time, and then the consequential impact that had on the regions of Spain. And you could take the view that the surge in sort of independence movements within Spain is kind of a consequence of Franco's power in the 70s, from the 30s to the 70s.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Any last thoughts, Stu?
Like I say, for me, it's just fascinating. It is absolutely fascinating. I thought I had a very rudimentary, I suppose, knowledge of Spanish history and Franco, but it's just gone up exponentially listening to you two guys tonight. And again, like I always say, these particular episodes just leave me. I just walk away from the laptop and straight into the nearest book or website to try and pick up the threads or the most interesting threads that I've heard. It's just a wonderful hour. It really is.
Can I say one final thing before we finish?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I live in a district of Liverpool called Crosby, which is North Liverpool. About a mile away from me is a school called Merchant Taylor School. It's a grammar school. As I'm sure Gary will know as well, yes. Barcelona's kit is based on Merchant Taylor's school's rugby kit, right? Because the Whitty brothers, who were influential in the early years of Barcelona, both attended Merchant Taylor's school, and the rugby kit that they wore when they were kids there was they were the colours they took over to Barcelona, and the red and blue kit, the Azulgrana, that Barcelona wear today, can date its heritage to a grammar school here in Crosby, North Liverpool.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I might sort of throw a spanner in your works here, Paul, because when you do the official tour of the Barcelona Stadium, I've done it a couple of times now, they tell a slightly different tale that Juan Gamper was at a club in Zurich. I wouldn't say it's Grasshoppers, I might be wrong, but the story, the official Barcelona story, is that Juan Gamper bought the red and blue stripes from his Swiss club. I'm aware of the might of the Merchant Taylor story as well, because that tie has that blue grana as well. So I, which one of those things is true, I don't know.
I think all I would say in that is I think Barcelona have been quite clever in rewriting their history and how some certain their traditions were there. Came about. I mean, certainly, yeah. I like yourself, Gary. I've done the Barcelona tour, but there's enough articles and enough research that kind of indicates that Merchant Taylors and Crosby definitely were the ones behind the colours.
Yeah, I've heard similar, and I guess as you say, it's sometimes people present the story they want people to believe rather than the one that's necessarily true.
It's a nice
romantic tale that Juan Gamper brought the colours across with him when he founded the club. So who can say? But I want to say a massive personal thanks, Paul, because I've enjoyed this area immensely. I've been looking forward to this, and I didn't think you'd let me down. We had a great discussion, and you didn't let me down. We've had a brilliant discussion. So massive thanks to you, Paul.
No, thanks to you, Gary, as well, because obviously your knowledge of the Spanish Civil War and Spanish football is just so impressive. And also massive thanks to you, Stu, because once again, you're so skilled letting the conversation flow. Coming in with the right set of questions at the right time, just to keep everything on track. And it's a very underrated skill, so I really do appreciate your leadership in these conversations as well.
Trust me, it's the easiest job in the world. It is. Just press record and just sit back. It's brilliant.
Okay, guys, that was a brilliant session. So massively enjoyed it, and I hope the listeners did too. That was the Political Football, looking at Spanish football in the era of Franco. Thanks for listening in, and we look forward to you joining us next time on the Political Football.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.